Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. What do the following films have in common? Zodiac, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and The Social Network. If you said that they were all directed by David Fincher, give yourself a pat on the back. And please talk a bit louder so I can hear you, okay? Okay. As luck would have it, our next guest knows a lot about David Fincher. Film critic Adam Naiman is the author of David Fincher, Mind Games. In his book, Adam explores Fincher's exacting perfectionism, his fascination with serial killers and conspiracy theories, and making the mundane memorable. Through his Naiman-esque, incisive analysis of each film, Adam makes the case that David Fincher is one of the finest filmmakers working today.
He's one of the few contemporary American directors whose methodology is kind of famous. I mean, a lot of directors are famous for their personality or for their private lives or their political stances or for other sort of celebrity things. Fincher is famous for lots of takes and for control, right? And while that fits maybe in one of the archetypes of a film direction that's kind of endured since Hitchcock and Kubrick, you know, I mean, off the top of your head, you know film, and our friends know film, but I mean, how many directors are household names, and then how many directors are household names because they're a little bit of a taskmaster, right? So Fincher is a rare case of someone who most people don't just know that he's a filmmaker, but they know that he's an exacting one. So there's lots of places you can go to read about how he makes movies and hear him say how he does it and hear him justify the, you know, added labor and added time and repetition. The larger question that I wanted to broach was not, you know, how do you keep building up the myth of David Fincher, or how do you, you know, judge the myth of David Fincher's methods? It's what do those methods come to? And if you're going to conclude that they come to well-made, successful, entertaining movies, that's kind of obvious, right? You know, are these well-made, successful, entertaining movies? And I think that there's a wide range, even if not of like, maybe not a wide range of interpretations in terms of like what happens in the movies. I don't think his movies are ambiguous the way someone like David Lynch's movies are ambiguous. You know, they're pretty left to right and linear and narrative driven. But, you know, are we watching exploitation? Are we watching something that has humane empathy? Are we watching something that's political? Are we watching something that's product? Are we watching the logical culmination of a music video virtuoso working in feature format? I find that there's a lot of debate over those things. And I think that he's become popular and influential and established enough that there's some urgency to that debate. And I think the debate over David Fincher in 1993 and the debate over David Fincher in 2021 are strangely similar, even though there's a much longer body of work now as a staging ground for that debate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fincher also directed music videos, most famously for Madonna and the Rolling Stones, And even maybe less famously for our fellow Canadians, Loverboy. How did he draw on this experience when he started making movies?
I mean, I think that he was part of a cycle of music video directors who were drawing on movies for the music videos. So by the time they ended up making feature films, the visual language and the ambition were already there, right? The signature of his music videos is oddly impersonal. And what I mean by that is the reason he got hired by so many bands, including Loverboy and including all these mid-level pop bands before the top 40 bands, was the videos aren't about David Fincher, right? The style, the lensing, the color palette, the cutting, yeah, you can recognize him in it, but it's never to the point of overshadowing the artist. I mean, I would say maybe the best thing he's ever directed, minute for minute, is the video for Freedom 90 by George Michael, which only in retrospect feels Fincherian because there's shots in it that he would repeat in Panic Room and in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. But that video is so complex because of the way it's about George Michael's identity and him saying goodbye to his Wham! Phase and his 80s phase, and he's declaring a kind of more fluid sexuality, and he's being lip-synced by these beautiful, nude supermodels. who become, you know, like the conduit that George Michael is speaking through. It's a phenomenal video. And Fincher is all over it in terms of how it's made, but it's about George Michael. That's why he kept getting all those music video commissions. And then once he gets into feature film, I think his personality and the idea that he's maybe making movies for and about himself starts becoming a little more evident.
Interesting. You described Fincher's second feature film, Seven, as a movie that teaches us how to watch it as it goes along and also how to rewatch it later on. I was very intrigued by that statement. How so? Can you explain that?
It's a movie that just holds people completely rapt, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's because the audience's perception is constantly being guided in shallow focus through these really sort of suggestive compositions. He's showing you to look for clues. He's showing you to look for, important flashes of color or important objects. He's turning you into a detective, but it's deceptive because it's not your own powers of perception. You're kind of like reading the signs that he's putting out there for you.
Oh, wait. Gould's wife. She was out of town at the time. So this means she saw something.
What if it's a threat?
Well, I put her in a safe house. She wasn't too happy about it.
What if it isn't something she has seen, but something she's supposed to see but hasn't been given a chance?
You okay, what?
I don't know. But that's the one thing.
It's making you complicit. I mean, there's that amazing bit when at one of the crime scenes they find that the word "help me" has been written in fingerprints on the wall. I mean, what more lucid a description of artistry than, you know, using fingerprints, right? Now, they turn out to not be the killer's fingerprints. It turns out they're someone else's, but the message that they spell out that he's written in fingerprints is "help me." And the first interpretation of that phrase by the detectives is, you know, that idea of a cry for help, that idea he wants to stop, you know? But what it really is saying is it's saying, help me complete this design. Without an investigator, without an audience, without a viewer, what the killer is doing is meaningless. And without us to sort of sit and want the puzzle to be completed, what Fincher is doing is meaningless. He makes us want the killer to succeed, and he makes us want the cops to fail, because otherwise we're denied the shape and pleasure of the killer's overall design. And that's one of the things about the movie that I think is really extraordinary, that whether you know it or not, and without without being an immoral person or without being, you know, a perverse person, you kind of want the killer to see this thing through to the end, because you're going to feel cheated otherwise. And that's a really ingenious and diabolical and affecting structure for a thriller.
Vallejo Police Department.
I want to report a double murder.
May I have your
name?
If
you go 1 mile east on Columbus Parkway, a public park, you'll find kids in a brown car. They were shot with a 9mm Luger. I also killed those kids last year. Goodbye.
12 years after Seven, Fincher made another movie about a serial killer, Zodiac. And this was not only his first film based on a true story, it was also his first period piece and his first time shooting fully digitally. How did these three firsts affect the way he directed Zodiac?
I'm not shy about saying I think Zodiac's his great work. You know, I think that his great theme is procedure, and I think that Zodiac is his great expression of that theme. So, you know, shooting digitally meant a kind of control and manipulation of the image, not only in terms of setting the film in the past, but an ability to show time passing incrementally that, wouldn't be as easy without digital effects and trickery, like the time-lapse reconstruction of the Trans-America period in Zodiac, which shows time slipping away. You know, I think that making a movie based on the real and based on history opened up some new avenues or portals towards terror or towards tension, because not just because you're dealing with something real, but because you are moving from a stylized world like the one in Seven, which is meant as a kind of, you know, the worst possible version of ours, you know, into a more recognizable and everyday version of our world, but that still plays host to that kind of depravity and that kind of psychosis. And I think that Zodiac is a wonderful, not apology for Seven, but I think it's a wonderful follow-up in that it takes everything that's kind of perfect about the original movie, like the fact that it has a killer who lives up to his methods, and it completely reroutes that. There's no monster at the end of the movie. And so instead of that perfect Iron Maiden-like structure you have in Seven, where everything closes and you know, comes together, Zodiac is totally open-ended.
When is it going to be finished? When you catch him? When you arrest him?
Be serious.
I am serious.
I need to know who he is. I need to stand there. I need to look him in the eye. And I need to know that it's him.
And that open-endedness, I think, is very haunting and is very daring for Fincher at that point in his career to make something that's in its way so unsatisfying.
Yeah, absolutely. Along with serial killers, Fincher seems kind of obsessed with conspiracy theories, perhaps most famously in The Game and in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Right.
What is it about conspiracy that draws him in?
Well, I think, yeah, conspiracy and conspiracy maybe as a hint, or conspiracy as a confirmation of a paranoid and sinister reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that that's very much Fincher's kind of game playing side, and you know, there's something very kind of cool and metaphysical about, you know, turning reality into a kind of game, or turning reality almost into a game of chicken, and that's, you know, kind of some of the same stuff that plays into The Game, where Michael Douglas is so bored with his life and this opportunity arises to shake it up. And then as soon as his life starts changing, he can't tell if this is the fun experience that he signed up for, or if he's being basically, you know, taken for all he's worth by a bunch of con men.
It's invisible ink.
You're joking.
This is what I'm dealing with. I'm being toyed with by a bunch of depraved children.
Are you okay? Tell me not to worry.
You don't have to worry. I promise. Okay.
And I think that those movies are really fun when they're in that ambiguous space. I think that a movie like The Game, when it wraps up, as I write in the book, maybe arguably undersells some of its own ideas by having such a clear resolution. But when you're in the paranoid midpoint of that movie, it's pretty exhilarating stuff.
Yeah, definitely. One of your favorite scenes in any Fincher film is the opening back and forth discussion at the beginning of The Social Network between Mark Zuckerberg, played by Jesse Eisenberg, and his girlfriend Erica Albright, played by Rooney Mara. Well, why?
Because of the velocity of it, you know? And I think that it's interesting. In Zodiac, he started playing with time in such a way that time really drags out and becomes incrementalized, and the film has this sense of epic sweep. In Benjamin Button, the pacing is very slow. You feel time almost kind of ticking away, or time draining away. And then The Social Network, which is this kind of millennial study of power and of media control, and all of a sudden things accelerate.
And what part of Long Island are you from? Wimbledon?
Wait.
I'm going back to
wait,
my dorm.
Wait. Is this real?
Yes.
Okay, then wait. I apologize, okay?
I have to go study.
Erica?
Yes?
I'm sorry. I mean it.
I appreciate that, but I have to go study.
Come on. You don't have to study. You don't have to study. Let's just talk.
I can't.
Why?
Because it is exhausting. Dating you is like dating a stairmaster.
All I meant is that you're not likely to... currently. I wasn't making a comment on your parents. I was just saying that you go to BU. I was stating a fact. That's all. And if it seemed rude, then of course I apologize.
I have to go study.
You don't have to study.
Why do you keep saying I don't have to study?
Because you go to BU.
Because these are characters whose synapses flash very quickly. They're smart, they're Ivy League, but there's also something with their narcissism and their solipsism that speeds them up. And so I love that scene because it evokes 30s screwball, but in a 21st century context where everything old feels new again. And I love the way that the speed keeps changing. Like, their dialogue is so fast. And then his trip home from the bar after they break up, even though he's jogging, it's got a really sort of glacial, funereal pace, because in the physical world, Mark Zuckerberg is just kind of, you know, slow. I mean, he's not strong and fast enough to row crew, which is what his rivals do. He's kind of like Pac-Man, moving a little bit slowly through all those winding Harvard corridors. And then as soon as he gets online, everything accelerates again. Because you get him in front of a keyboard and you get his brain going in the context of coding and building a website, and then all of a sudden he's fast again. So I find that Social Network is where this newish phase of Fincher that definitely carries through in Dragon Tattoo and Gone Girl, where you have him locating clarity in speed. And that's a hard thing to do, because in speed, when you're working with that kind of speed and you're cutting and you're storytelling, you'd think you'd miss all the details. But he actually finds a way to make these incredibly fast movies where the details keep jumping out at you. And that's the alchemy that I'm always dazzled by with him, is this yoking of speed to clarity, which he does like no filmmaker I can think of.
After researching and writing this book, you must now have a grand unified theory of David Fincher's cinematic universe. Could you share it with us?
Well, I think the theory of the universe is the way the book is divided as this kind of dossier, right? Where there's these mm-hmm. distinct interests and themes, and they taken together, they kind of make up a psychological profile of a filmmaker. I mean, I think his universe is, if not a godless one, if not purely nihilistic, I think, you know, it's an anxious one.
Yeah.
And a lot of those things that we might want to think can, you know, offset that, or redeem that, sort of are in short supply, or you have to look very, very hard for them in his movies.
Yeah, definitely. Very well said. Adam Naiman, thank you for joining us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on David Fincher Mind Games.
That's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Adam Naiman is a film critic and the author of David Fincher Mind Games. Find out more about Fincher at wpr.org/beta.
Early on, members of the group recognized that he had not only his skills as a dancer and not only this unique physicality, but that he could also rap.
Wisconsin native Charles L. Hughes joins us to talk about rapper Bushwick Bill. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.